indistinguishable. The cave was Spartan in its decor. Other than the construct holding the old man, there were few furnishings. A couple of chairs, a great mirror with an ornate silver frame, and a battered old wardrobe covered in chains that were fastened with dozens of padlocks. Nearer the back was something resembling an altar, and on it was a human head draped with a scarlet cloth. This didn't bother the old man, who had seen many heads in his time. What rattled him was the fact that he had heard his captor talking to it before it had been placed in the cave. A clicking and popping noise, the sounds of thousands of insects scuttling across the granite floor, told him that his captor had returned and was approaching the mouth of the cave. The old man's arms tensed against the leather thongs that tied him to the frame. It was normally used for skinning animals, but it served its current purpose just as well. The clicking noises subsided, and a sallow voice echoed throughout the small cavern.
"Where did you send her?"
his captor asked, as he had the night before, and the night before that, but more insistent this time.
"I must know. It is in your best interests that I know."
"She's out of your reach, and that's all that matters," said the old man. "Where she has gone, you cannot follow." His captor responded with a sound that was half laughter, half a contemptuous snort.
"You don't think I know where she's gone, or that I can't follow her as I choose?"
"Follow her?" said the old man. "You can't even enter this cave. So I don't think you are as free as you think. Because if you were, you wouldn't need me." The other speaker started to spit out a reply, then seemed to acquiesce.
"Well played. But I mean to find out, whatever it takes."
The voice became lower then, almost a purr, as a different approach was tested.
"Ah, you and I, Peter. We are old adversaries, are we not? But does that not also make us brothers of a sort? And can we not set aside old grievances and come together? You could be first among my allies, my most trusted general. What do you say?"
With the mention of his name, the old man's eyes widened in alarm, before settling into a resigned calmness. He smiled and let out a short chuckle. Echoing off the cave walls, it sounded like the laughter of a child.
"You finally made a mistake," the old man said. "I know who you are now. That has always been your problem. You simply can't bear for anyone not to know who's really pulling the strings, so to speak. I wasn't going to help you to begin with. But now, never."
"I could make you tell," his captor hissed.
The old man chuckled again.
"Not likely. The pipes don't work on Longbeards."
"All right,"
the other speaker said, retreating a bit.
"Perhaps if I offered you something you value more than power. If you will simply tell me where you sent the girl, and for what purpose, then perhaps I will allow you to return to the well one last time."
The old man laughed once more, but could not disguise the brief flash of longing that crossed his features. He blinked and pursed his lips.
"Thank you, no. I think I'll take my chances. Being old isn't as bad as I expected it to be. After all, you know what they say. You're as young as you feel."
He tipped his head back and crowed, and the sound was both mocking and triumphant. And then he smiled. The sudden crescendo of insect noises told the old man that his captor was both livid and gesturing to summon his servants. In a moment, several animals had filled the cave entrance. A few made snuffling sounds, one or two were growling. All seemed to be waiting for further instruction. One of them sneezed, then rubbed at its face with a grubby, five-fingered paw. And then the old man realized they were not animals after all. They were children. The wolf child sneezed again. Irritated and distracted, the captor snarled a rebuke, and in that moment the old man saw his chance. Quickly, he whispered a few words in an ancient tongue, and in an instant his shadow had separated itself from his body and flew along the ceiling of the cave toward the opening. His captor cursed and ordered the feral children inside the cave to kick sand over the fire, reducing it to smoke and embers. But it was too late. The beast children looked to their leader for the order to pursue this new prey, but he shook his head.
"Let it go. It isn't that important. It is only his shadow, after all."
Again he addressed the old man, who was hanging more slackly in the frame, but whose eyes were now glittering.
"Let's begin again, shall we?"
"I can't believe it," said Jack, his voice echoing loudly through the halls of the great Watsit. "We're trying too hard to find meaning in meaningless things. You're seeing connections that aren't there, John."
"No, he isn't," said Bert,
who had calmed down somewhat.
"In fact, I think John is exactly right. I think William was trying to pass a message on, and Peter got it, which is why he sent Laura Glue to Jamie."
"Perhaps this was the lever the Morgaine referred to,"
Charles offered.
"It did reveal a missing dragon ship."
"Don't take this the wrong way," said Jack. "But what's the logic that holds this all together?"
"The ship," said a voice from the open doorway. "Father's right. The ship Bacon described wasn't just any vessel. It was the Red Dragon." As one, the companions turned and looked at the speaker. Tall, with a more regal bearing than they'd remembered, despite her rough sailor's clothing, Avon regarded them all coolly before lifting her chin and giving them a half-smile.
"I must admit," she said, "I didn't think two of you would come, much less all three. But I'm...
Bert rushed to his daughter and wrapped his arms around her. She stiffened at first, then relaxed and returned his embrace. Avon looked up at the three caretakers and gave them a sincere, if weary, smile.
"I'm very pleased to see you, all of you."
One by one, she gave each of them a brief hug and kisses on both cheeks. Not an entirely informal greeting, but when she came to Artus, she gave him the same, no more, no less. Charles and John exchanged a puzzled glance, which didn't escape Artus's notice.
"You didn't tell them, did you?" he said to Bert.
"Tell them what?" said Avon.
"It's none of our business," said Jack, who had also noted the casual way she had greeted the king. "It's just that if we hadn't known better, we wouldn't have thought you were greeting your husband." Avon looked startled.
"Husband? You mean Artus?"
Of course," John stammered. "He's the king, and you're, Avon lifted her chin and looked at them.
"He is the king," she said, "but he is not now, nor has he ever been my husband."
But, Jack started, that's... He stopped speaking and just looked from Avon to Artus, dumbfounded.
"Aren't you the queen, Avon?"
Charles asked.
"I had the understanding."
Artus cut off the discussion with a gesture.
"She is, for all intents and purposes, the royal consort. In effect, she is queen. She and no other helps me to guide the affairs of the archipelago. But if we had married, formally, as a matter of statesmanship, then she would have been expected to remain on Parallon, and that would not have made her happy."
"So you refused to marry Artus, just so you wouldn't have to be confined to Parallon?" said Jack.
"You misunderstand," said Artus. "I chose not to force her into a marriage that would have filled her days with sorrow and longing."
"Bear in mind," John said to Jack, "this is the archipelago. Our conventions are not necessarily theirs."
"I'm just a bit startled, is all," Jack said. "I apologize, Avon, for saying anything out of turn."
You didn't, said Avon. But now you know, and despite my wanderlust, I always come back to Parillon. My family is here, both Artus and—
Her voice broke, and she pulled her vest tighter. She turned to Artus.
I've toured the entire northern perimeter of Parillon. Not a single ship escaped being torched. It's almost as if a signal was given to an invisible enemy, and all of them were destroyed in a single stroke. Have you heard any news from Samaranth?
Artus hesitated, then shook his head. The last report came just as we sent Bert for the caretaker Principia. There's been nothing since then. He paused, considering. Come to think of it, I haven't seen any dragons in more than a day. I wonder where they've all gotten to.
And the children? Asked Bert. Are there any more missing?
From every village, Avon said. The only ones who were spared were too small or ill.
One escaped, said Charles. A girl with artificial wings, who called herself Laura Glue.
Laura Glue? Exclaimed Avon. Where is she? Is she here? What did she say?
Actually, said Jack, we left her sleeping in a wardrobe at James Barry's house. At the mention of Barry, Avon's expression darkened, but she only nodded in understanding.
That's who she should have gone to. Tell me everything.
After Artus, Bert, and the caretakers gave her a hurried explanation, Avon sat at the table and looked over the book where they had found mention of a crusade.
Jamie didn't know what the message meant, said Bert. The crusade has begun. It meant nothing to him, except for a fragment of a memory.
This is the fragment, Avon said, tapping the book. This message is what tells me so, and Jamie knows more than he's led you to believe.
Why? John wondered. What can possibly connect Jamie and the two men Bacon wrote about? And why wouldn't he tell us if he knew something more? Avon set her jaw and looked at John.
Ollie Oxenfree was the game Peter and Jamie taught all the Lost Boys. They invented it. It's not a coincidence that the game and its creators are mentioned in the same passage. The ship described in that book, the Red Dragon, has been seen firsthand only once in the history of the archipelago. Everything else has been a story, the friend of a friend whose cousin once saw it, sort of stories. Even here in the archives, despite centuries of writing and record-keeping, there have hardly ever been any mentions of it at all.
Precisely four, Bert interjected. The first recorded sighting was when Ordo Mars built it from the wreck of the Argo. The second was during the first great battle between Arthur and Mordred. The accounting you just read would be the third.
When was the fourth? Artus asked.
Avon glanced at her father and hesitated.
It's in a book from Verne's personal archive. A future history that may or may not happen. And that's what concerns me. The Red Dragon seems lost not just in space, but also in time. The Morgaine said that the change that altered the course of history occurred 7 centuries ago, but that the event that caused the change happened only 9 years ago because of something you did.
Really, said John, I've racked my brain trying to figure out what we did wrong, but I can't think of anything we did that wasn't necessary to defeat Mordred.
Jules would say that nothing you did was wrong, young John, said Bert. There are only choices that move us into the future, even if at times we seem to go back. It stands to reason that all of this is connected, and there was only one place you went to where time itself could have been affected.
The Keep of Time, said Charles. Of course.
That's it then, said John. We're going back to see the cartographer of lost places.
The companions each said goodbye to Artus, who already appeared apprehensive about the line of officials who had gathered outside the library with yet more documents and decrees that needed his attention, and began winding their way out of the great Watsit. As Jack turned to follow the others, Artus grasped his arm and pulled him over to a shallow alcove.
I want to ask you something, the king said, his voice soft. I want to ask you if you will look after Avon, as a personal favor to me. I'm not asking as a king or anything, just me, Artus.
Jack started. He looked at the other man for a moment before answering.
Why are you asking me? Of course, all of us.
I know all of you will be looking out for one another, Artus interrupted, but that's not what I'm talking about. I know how you felt about her, Jack, before. I guess I've always known, so I hope you are not offended that I ask.
To the others?
She's a companion and a friend, but of all of them, only you would understand this request from someone who truly loves her.
Jack could see it in the young king's face. He did love Avon deeply, and it took more courage to ask this of Jack, his one-time rival for her affections, than Jack believed he could have mustered had their positions been reversed.
Of course I will, Artus.
Thank you, Jack, Artus said, offering his hand. Jack didn't hesitate to take Artus's hand and grip it tightly with his own.
I'll bring them back, Artus. Both of them.
It wasn't until he had walked out of the Great Watsit, toward where the others awaited him, that Jack realized how much he meant the words he'd just spoken. He did mean to bring back Avon and her son, but not necessarily back to Parallon. Aboard the Indigo Dragon once more, Avon instinctively slipped into command, as her father perceptively, subtly stepped aside. The crew were accustomed to her, and indeed seemed to step livelier to their tasks under her direction. Bert nodded contentedly and leaned against the forward spars as the airship lifted free from its moorings and rose into the air above Parallon. The smoke had been mostly cleared by the easterly winds, but a light haze remained, and the moon rose, unfocused, into the first frame of its nightly show. Charles, feeling a bit peckish, announced that he was going to go rummaging around in the galley below for something to eat. He was joined by Bert, who claimed to have learned a recipe from Tumala for an exceptional millet and barley soup.
"Good old Tumala," Charles said, as he opened the door and began descending the steps. "I've often thought about having him for a visit to Oxford and London. I think he'd have a marvellous time. It's just that..."
"Difficult to explain a talking badger," said Bert.
"Actually," confided Charles, "I was more worried about him getting wet. The smell, you know."
John stayed above, in part because he enjoyed the feeling of flight, but also to observe Jack. Since the trip had begun, neither he nor Charles had so much as mentioned Jack's turbulent feelings regarding the death of his friend in the Great War. Everything had been moving at such a breakneck pace that it seemed to have been overlooked that Jack's sleeplessness had begun long before the crisis in the archipelago. There were larger beasts to be grappled with in his friend's soul, and John was worried that if no one was watching, they might eventually devour Jack from the inside out. In their last voyage through the archipelago, it had been John who was traumatized by the events of the war, and who felt a profound loneliness at being separated from his wife. But then, he had been older to begin with and had more life experience than Jack in the 4 years that separated their ages. So coming to the archipelago as a caretaker of the Geographica was cathartic. It compelled him to find strengths he barely knew he possessed. But Jack had come there with a different set of perceptions, and then saw a friend die as a result of his own choices and actions. There was no way for someone else to gauge how that might affect a man, especially when yet another friend was later lost in battle, and there was no real family to return to ground oneself. Without turning around, Jack chuckled.
"I can feel your eyes burning holes in my back, John," he said. "I know you're concerned about me, but you needn't be. I can take care of myself."
"Of that I have no doubt," John assured him, sitting next to the railing. "But your friends are here to support you, Jack, in whatever way you need. And remember, I have some understanding of what you're dealing with." Jack started to retort, then caught himself and grinned wryly.
9 years ago, I might have argued with you, but I've realized in recent years that I sometimes argue just for the sake of arguing. I wonder why I do that."
"It's part of what makes you a good teacher," said John.
"Maybe," said Jack. "But with my students, I tend to win every time. It's not exactly fair."
John smiled. "You just need to learn the difference between arguing for arguing's sake and arguing when there's a point to be made. If it's the latter, then it won't matter if it's fair, just if it's right."
Jack looked at his friend for a moment, then turned back to the sea and sky, watching. The moon was fully above the horizon now, and it dominated the sky, turning the seas to cream and dispelling the last of the vaporous clouds that had obscured a sky of distant fireflies.
"It wasn't Warnie," Jack said suddenly.
"What wasn't Warnie?" asked John.
"It wasn't Warnie who began to call me Jack. It was my own idea. Came to me in a dream when I was a child, actually. I just woke up and announced to my family that I was to be addressed as Jack from then on. Sometime it was Jax or Jaxy, but Jack was what stuck, and Warnie was the first to pick it up. But I came up with the name myself."
John furrowed his brow and grinned wryly.
"Then why tell us Warnie came up with it? What's the difference?"
Jack shrugged. "I don't know. I supposed I just felt ill at ease telling anyone about the dreams. Maybe more so after recent events. The dreams I had about Avon and the giants, well, those were similar. But this time, no one was whispering that I should change my name."
"Well, if it's any consolation," John said, "I've never gone by John in my entire life. I've always preferred Ronald, but the military used my full name, and there were times when propriety required that I be introduced as John, and so that's how Professor Sigurdsson came to know me.
And then you fellows, of course.
But there's no one else in the world who knows me as John."
"We're not really in the world, in case you hadn't noticed," Jack noted.
"Point taken."
"So would you rather we called you Ronald?" asked Jack.
John shook his head.
"I don't think so. Being John is something I've come to associate with the Geographica and our travels together, and it's almost as if I've become a different person here, so John is fine."
"How about you?" Jack said, turning to Charles, who had just emerged from the galley licking his fingers. "Anything you'd like to share about your name or names?"
Charles cleared his throat.
"Well, I once wrote a play, starring myself, in which I assumed the identity of a great adventurer, modelled after Baron Munchausen, whose name was Brigadier General Throat Warbler Mangrove. I tried to coerce my friends to refer to me as Brigadier General, or at least T.M., but it never really took."
Jack's eyes goggled.
"That's amazing."
John laughed and snorted.
"How old were you when that idiotic idea crossed your mind?"
"It was last month," said Charles, looking slightly put out.
"Sorry," said John.
"You'd have been in fine company,"
Bert said as he emerged from the cabin with two steaming mugs of millet and barley soup.
"Baron Munchausen wasn't his real name either,"
he said, handing a mug to Charles.
"Really?"
said Charles.
"What was it?"
Bert puffed his cheeks and blew on the hot soup.
"Ramon Felipe, San Juan Mario Silvio, Enrico Smith, Heathcourt Brace, Sierra y Alvarez del Rey y de los Verdes. But we called him Lester." "Dear God!"
Charles shook his head.
"I'm sorry I asked."
The night passed uneventfully, although Avon's expression grew darker every time she noted the lack of ships on the great expanse below them. Bert, Avon, and the crew knew the way to the smaller archipelago, where the keep was located, well enough to make consulting Tumler's Geographica unnecessary. This was a reprieve for John, who was hoping that his error in leaving the real Atlas in London wouldn't come up.
"We're approaching the islands," Avon said. "We should give the center a wide berth. Remember the steam from the volcanic cone? That will play havoc with the airship."
"She can't quite bring herself to call it the Indigo Dragon," Bert said to Jack.
"Still too attached to the old one, I'm afraid."
Avon tossed aside Jack's copy of the Geographica and snorted.
"These children's books are more a threat than anything. They don't note things important to navigation, and they skip too many of the dangers in the archipelago."
"Tamala probably worried that it would be bad for sales," Charles offered helpfully. "It's the publisher's dilemma."
"We'd probably better keep to the original," Avon said, turning to John. "That's what it's for, after all."
"Ah, about that," John began.
"Oh, my stars and garters,"
Bert exclaimed.
"I don't think this is a problem that can be dealt with by reading the Imaginarium Geographica."
The others crowded around the starboard side of the ship's railing to see what the old man was talking about. Just ahead, In the creeping light of morning, they could see the silhouettes of the necklace-shaped ring of islands amidst the ever-present steam. The stone columns of granite were just as the companions remembered them, with one stunning exception.
"The Keep of Time,"
Bert said in astonishment.
"It's gone."
Chapter 10. The Tower in the Air. The largest of the islands, where the Keep of Time had previously stood, was stark and barren. Eivind piloted the airship in a lazy circuit around the island so they could take a better look. Where the tower had been were a few scattered, loose stones, but no indication of the foundation. It was as if the tower had simply been removed.
"It seemed perfectly fine when we left it," said Charles. "I don't know what could possibly have happened to it."
"I'm beginning to," John said slowly as he paced the deck. "True, it was fine, but that was the second time we left, remember?" As one, the companions all realized what John was referring to, and suddenly the Morgaine's cryptic answers began to make much more sense. The Keep of Time had been an immense tower, inside of which were stairways leading upward to a seemingly infinite number of doors. Each one opened into a point in the past, with those at the bottom leading to the times most distant in prehistory, and they advanced chronologically as one ascended. Near the top, the stairs ended at a platform just short of the last door. That door opened into the future and was forever out of reach. Thus, the tower was constantly growing in tempo with the progression of time. The next to last door, behind which they found the creator of the Imaginarium Geographica, who was known as the Cartographer of Lost Places, was the only one that opened to the present. But behind the fourth door from the top, John had found he was only in the recent past, and indeed had a conversation with his dead mentor, Professor Sigurdsson, there. After John's encounter with the professor, and their subsequent meeting with the cartographer, the companions had descended the stairway to find their adversary, Mordred, the Winter King, had arrived on the island as well, and he had set the base of the keep on fire. The companions had gone in the only direction they could, up, and as they climbed, Charles conceived of the plan that would ultimately save them all. He proposed opening the door below the cartographers and escaping into the immediate past, and sure enough, the door opened into the entrance at the base of the tower, 1 hour before the Winter King arrived. The companions then simply boarded their ship and left. Eivind stared at the island in shock. "We left safely, but an hour later Mordred still came here, and he still set the fire."
"It never occurred to me that the Winter King might still have stormed the tower," said Bert. "I always assumed he'd looked for us, not found us, and simply began to pursue us again."
"Same here," said John. "Everything came to such a head on Terminus that I didn't stop to think of what had gone before." Charles was mortified.
You mean it's my fault the tower was destroyed?"
His legs began to wobble, and he sat heavily on the deck, his head in his hands. Bert laid a reassuring hand on his shoulder.
"You aren't to blame, Charles. Mordred's actions were his own. You were the hero. You actually thought of a way to escape when no one else had an answer. Mordred had already started the fire. After we escaped, he simply did it again."
Bert's words had no effect on an inconsolable Charles.
"I destroyed it," he murmured, disbelieving. "I destroyed the keep."
He sat up straighter.
"Worse, I destroyed time. That's what the Morgaine were talking about. I actually wiped out an entire dimension."
"This really is some kind of extraordinary achievement," John said supportively. "Not many people can lay claim to having broken time, and we did it purely by accident."
"Oh, I don't think it's as bad as all that," said Bert. "Time is sturdier than you'd think, but I do believe we've found the source of the crisis."
"Shouldn't there be debris?" asked John. "I mean, even if the tower was burned, shouldn't it have left a huge pile of rubble? A bunch of scorched stones? Something?"
"It wasn't an ordinary tower," Bert replied. It was actually made of time. Well, and granite, and, ragthorn wood, but there's no telling how it would be affected.
As John, Charles, and Bert debated, Avon noticed that Jack was on the opposite side of the deck and hadn't been looking at the island at all.
"What are you looking at, Jack?" she asked. "You've been staring at the water since we got here."
"Look at this," Jack said, waving her over without taking his eyes off the sea below.
"There, just below us, see? That dark impression in the water. Could it be some sort of submarine, like the Yellow Dragon?"
Avon squinted and peered down to where Jack was pointing.
"It's not a ship. It's a shadow. See, where the airship is casting a similar shadow on the water, and how it changes position with the light."
"Huh?" said Jack. "Whatever's casting that is a great deal bigger than the Indigo." Jack stopped and swallowed hard. He and Avon looked at each other as a sudden realization occurred to them. Then together, they looked straight up.
"Oh, shades," said Jack.
Charles was just starting to collect himself when Jack and Avon rejoined the others. They were both grinning like Cheshire cats.
"What?" said John. "What are you two smiling about?"
"Good news," announced Jack. "Charles didn't destroy the tower after all."
"Not all of it, anyway," said Avon.
"I'm confused," said Bert.
As if on cue, the Indigo Dragon circled around to a point opposite the island and the risen sun, and the broken shadow that split the sea to the northern horizon fell across the airship. The companions and crew all looked upward and saw what was casting the shadow. High above them, like a great grey comet frozen in its descent to Earth, was the Keep of Time.
"Oh, thank God," said Charles.
As the airship began to ascend, it occurred to the companions more than once that what they were attempting would have been impossible with any of the other dragon ships, including the original Indigo Dragon. In terms of distance, the tower was only perhaps 2 miles above them, but if that measurement were applied to the portion of the keep that had been consumed by fire, then it represented thousands, perhaps even millions of years of history. The Indigo Dragon approached the lower part of the floating tower and confirmed their supposition. It was jagged and charred, and the damage rose several hundred feet higher, then stopped. At some point, something had stayed the advance of the flames, but the damage done was inconceivable. Avon guided the ship higher to a point considerably past the charred portions, and at Bert's direction threw an anchor line through one of the windows that opened into the stairway. Once secured, they maneuvered close enough to tether a rope ladder fashioned from the old ship's riggings.
"We kept some of it out of nostalgia, you know," said Bert,
and one by one they began to climb across. Inside, the keep was exactly as they remembered it, save for the haze that obscured what remained of the lower levels.
"Watch your step," Bert warned. "Wouldn't be advisable to slip off the stairs."
"You're a master of the obvious," said Jack.
"You're the caretaker principia," Avon said to John. "Lead on."
Together, the companions began to climb. It took sustained climbing for most of the day to reach the uppermost doors. The tower was silent, except for an occasional rumbling noise that emanated from below.
"Forgive the sentiment," said Charles, panting slightly, "but I almost wish the fire had burned up more of the place, so we wouldn't have quite so far to walk."
"I'm with Charles," said Jack. "I still don't understand why we couldn't just fly the ship higher and enter a window closer to the cartographer's room."
"Because," Bert said, "the Keep of Time is also a judge of character. Remember how the last time the descent seemed to take less time than the climb up? That's because it did. And you recall the door we stepped through for our escape?"
"Right," said John. "When we went through, it opened up down below only an hour earlier from when we'd entered."
"It took us where and when we needed to go," Bert affirmed, "because we earned it by our efforts. We could have flown higher, true, but I suspect it would not have shortened the distance we needed to climb."
As if on cue, the ceiling seemed suddenly closer. The stairway ended, and the next door bore the keyhole that marked the room where they would find the cartographer.
"You're welcome,"
Bert said to no one in particular. As before, the door was locked, but Avon, as queen, had a ring that bore the seal of the High King. A touch was all it took. There was a soft click as the lock disengaged, and the door swung inward. The cartographer of Lost Places was sitting at his desk, concentrating on a very elaborate map.
"If I've told you once, I've told you thrice," he said, irritated. "I haven't the faintest idea who killed Edwin Drood, so you can just stop asking. You wouldn't be in this mess if you hadn't started that dratted serial."
"Edwin Drood?" John inquired, stepping forward into the densely cluttered room. "I haven't asked you anything about Edwin Drood." The cartographer frowned and peered at his visitors over the top of his glasses.
"Really? Aren't you the caretaker Principio?"
"Well, yes, but..."
"Hold on a moment,"
the cartographer said. He hopped off his chair and strode over to John.
"You're not Charles?"
That would be me," said Charles.
"Really?"
exclaimed the cartographer.
"How extraordinary. You used to be much more handsome."
"What?"
Charles sputtered.
"But I've only seen you the one time."
"Nonsense. You've been here plenty of times,"
said the cartographer.
"Although I wish you'd get rid of that apprentice of yours. He's a bad egg, that one. What was his name? Maggot something?"
"Magwitch," said Charles. "And that's the first thing you've said that's made sense."
"Hmm,"
said the cartographer.
"You really aren't Dickens, are you?"
"None of us is," Jack put in.
"It's for the best,"
the cartographer said.
"He was a clever fellow, but he had terrible judgment when it came to apprentices. First Maggot, then that explorer fellow who snuck into Mecca. Just asking for trouble, the whole lot of them."
Bert moved in front of the others to try to get the mapmaker to focus.
"Do you remember me, at least?"
he asked. The cartographer tilted back his head.
The far traveller, unless I'm mistaken, which is seldom. Yes, yes, I do know you. What year is it, anyway?"
"It's 1926,
said Charles.
"Excellent to hear," said the cartographer. "It's helpful to know time keeps moving forward, even as the past vanishes into smoke and ash."
About that,
Charles began before Avon stomped on his foot. She scowled and put a finger to her lips.
"We noticed there'd been a situation," said Bert.
"Situation?"
the cartographer exclaimed.
"More like a catastrophe, if you ask me. Someone set fire to the keep and burned up an awful lot of history. It burned for nearly 6 years, you know."
"How did you finally manage to put it out?" asked Jack.
"Put it out? Me?"
said the cartographer.
"Hello? Didn't you just notice the lock on the door? I couldn't lift a finger, just had to wait it out."
"How did it go out?"
asked Bert. The cartographer sat cross-legged on the floor and indicated that the others should sit as well.
"I think it went out when it reached the doors that opened up to the end of the Silver Age, or the beginning of the Bronze," he said, "around 1600 BC or thereabouts. That would have done the trick."
"What happened at the beginning of the Bronze Age?"
Charles whispered to John.
"Deucalion's flood," John replied.
"Yep,"
said the cartographer, winking at Charles.
"Water out the yin-yang. It also put out the Thera eruption, so it could certainly douse a little tower fire."
"Well," said Charles, "at least it stopped the damage before it could take the whole tower out."
"Stopped?"
the cartographer said in surprise.
"Slowed, maybe, but not stopped. The entire base of the keep is missing, or hadn't you noticed? The fire may be out, but the foundation is gone, and the structure is fatally weakened. Stones continue to fall into the sea, and door by door, the tower is still vanishing. What remains is only here because it's in the future, but our past catches up to us. It always does."
"What happens when it finally gets to the top?" asked John. "What will happen to you?"
"Well, only one thing is certain," said the cartographer. "I'm finally going to get out of this damned room."
He stood up and dusted off the seat of his pants.
"Now, you didn't come up whatever stairs are still remaining to talk about my health.
he said wryly.
But anyone who's indifferent to the fate of Edwin Drood is okay in my book. So what can I do for you?
The companions took turns relating the story until all of the events had been laid out for the cartographer, who sat at his desk and listened without comment. When they had finished, he simply turned away and began to work on his map. John, Jack, and Charles looked at one another, bewildered, but Avon stepped to the desk and tapped the mapmaker on the shoulder. "Excuse me," she said, "but you might just be the rudest person I've ever met." The cartographer put down his quill.
"Really? What a boring life you must have led. I'm sorry, it was a lovely story. But was there a question?"
"About a million of them," cried Jack. "Where have all the children been taken? And the dragon ships? Who's burning all the other ships? And what happened to change history 700 years ago?"
The cartographer sighed heavily.
"No doubt you came to see me because of the nature of the keep, but my knowledge and understanding of it is rudimentary at best. I make maps. I make very good maps. I am the best map maker who ever lived. So if you need maps, I'm your man. But it isn't my fault or responsibility that someone ruined a tapestry on Avalon, or wrecked history, or did whatever they did that has the Morgaine's knickers in a twist. I also don't have the slightest idea where the children are, or who is burning your ships. Sorry. And as to the missing dragon ships, the Morgaine already told you where they are, and I wouldn't be surprised if the answers to some of your other problems come to light when you retrieve them."
Even Bert looked puzzled at this, and the cartographer let out an annoyed groan.
"And you call yourselves caretakers? The Morgades said they were in the underneath, guarded by the Caminus Lieber, did they not?"
"Sure," said John.
But nothing," said the cartographer. "The last time you paid me a visit, how did you find the Keep of Time to begin with?"
John blinked a few times, then his eyes grew wide, and his face turned a deep crimson. "I'd forgotten," he said.
"So," said the cartographer, "the other shoe drops again."
"We don't have to go looking for Caminus Lieber," John told the others sheepishly. "We're already there. This chain of islands here was called Caminus Lieber in the notes in the Geographica."
"I remember," declared Charles. "You'd set it aside as unimportant because it was a mishmash of Latin and ancient Greek, and all the notes about it were otherwise in Italian."
"Alighieri," said the cartographer. "Now there was a caretaker. Even came back from the dead so his sons could finish that little poem. You'd never catch him whining about Drood this and Drood that."
"So why did you call it that?" Jack asked the cartographer. "Why Caminus Lieber?" The mapmaker shrugged.
"It wasn't named by me. It was named by someone much older. Actually, a granduncle of sorts, now I think about it. But if your caretaker Principia had paid just a bit more attention, half of your problems might be over already."
"Why half?" asked Charles.
"As you've already noted, Caminus Lieber is mixed Latin and ancient Greek, and the meaning of Latin words can change with specific usage. Lieber doesn't mean book. It means boy. Translated properly, Caminus Lieber means lost boys."
At the revelation, Avon stiffened, although no one noticed but Jack, and he couldn't tell if it was from dismay or from shock like the rest of them. "So the islands themselves guard the underneath, whatever that is," said John.
"You're getting your wind, philologically speaking,"
observed the cartographer.
"The rest should be a breeze."
"The rest?" John said.
"And you were so close to having my respect," said the cartographer. "The underneath is an extension of the archipelago, another chain of islands formed of circles within circles beneath the surface of the earth. It's not recorded in the Geographica because no one really goes there anymore, so I never got around to making any maps for it. The underneath is very, very old. Some of the islands even predate the Drowned Lands. And the last time I was there, I hadn't yet learned cartography, and I even had a name. Thus, most of what is in the Geographica that concerns the underneath was added later by various caretakers. Only three traveled there with any frequency, although I know others from your world have made their way to it now and again.
Who are the three?
Asked Charles.
Dante Alighieri, of course, and that Frenchman, what's his name, who planned that foolish trip to the moon?
You mean Jules Verne?
Bert guessed. The cartographer snapped his fingers.
That's the one, Verne. And the third was that young boy, a whelp. Can't have been more than 12 at most. Awfully young for a caretaker, if you ask me. But you lot seldom do any more.
A 12-year-old caretaker? Exclaimed John. That sounds pretty unlikely.
That's what I told him, said the cartographer. But he had the Geographica, after all, so I had to take him at his word. I think his name was Barry something.
Avon went white. Barry, she said, her voice breaking. His name is James Barry.
What it is, said the cartographer, waving his hands dismissively. I can't keep you all straight any more.
How do we get to the underneath? Asked Jack.
That's simple, replied the cartographer. The portal is straight down through the center of the volcanic cone, and the phrase that opens the passage is inscribed in the Imaginarium Geographica, so accessing and opening the portal should be no problem.
Reflexively, Jack, Charles, and Bert all looked at John, whose face began to turn several shades of red again. Avon's eyes narrowed, and she took an accusatory stance as she realized why John was suddenly so embarrassed. The cartographer sighed.
Oh, bosh and bother, bother and bosh, he said, exasperated. Now I remember you. Sigurdsson's student, the soldier who fancied himself a scholar. Misplaced it again, have you?
John began stammering out an explanation about the Geographica, and Laura Glue's wings, and his car, and how they did have copies of the atlas that had been transcribed by a badger, which might have the information they need, and had started in on a half-hearted apology, when the cartographer held up his hands.
No offence, but I don't care, he said matter-of-factly. I can't really be more helpful here, and considering that there are four caretakers present and no Geographica, I'd say the criteria for choosing caretakers is rather more lax than it used to be.
In a fashion, it actually is in the possession of a caretaker, reasoned John. The automobile is just down the street from James Barry's house.
Is that a defense?
Said the cartographer.
That you left it a world away, near the home of a caretaker who actually walked away from the job?
He looked at Avon and raised his eyebrows.
Who are these people? The Marx Brothers?
Avon smiled, resigned. Anything you can offer us would be helpful, she said. Anything at all. The cartographer regarded her carefully.
I remember you, too. You're the angry one. But not so much any more, I think. Why is that?
Avon looked startled by this sudden focus on her. I couldn't say, she stammered. Perhaps I just grew up?
Maybe, said the cartographer. I think there's more to you than most people give you credit for, and I'll bet my last drachma that you're not through growing.
Avon didn't respond, but simply met and held the mapmaker's gaze. After a moment, he looked away. The cartographer went to his window and looked out at the passing clouds. It was his solitary view, and changed only with the onset of nightfall. When he spoke again, it was more somberly than before.
I am truly sorry. I cannot be of more help to you. What you need is beyond my means. I can offer only this. What has happened to the Keep of Time was the sum of all the events that have gone before. It wasn't set in motion merely 1,000 years ago, or 700, or even 9, whatever any of you think.
This last was said with an understanding look at Charles, who nodded in acceptance and no small relief.
There may yet be other consequences, other effects springing from the cause. The tower is failing, and it was the loss of the lower part that has permitted crossings into the past where none were possible before. The doorways were focal points, nothing more, and the pathways to which they led are now drifting freely throughout the world. That something has already been changed 7 centuries ago means that someone, somewhere, has learned how to make use of this fact. And I tell you this now so that you are forewarned, O caretakers of the Geographica and the Archipelago. Be wary, be watchful, for time is now in the hands of your enemy.
Charles moved around the desk and offered his hand.
I do want to apologize. Whether it was my fault or not, someone should tell you they're sorry.
The cartographer hesitated, then shook the younger man's hand.
Thank you, Charles. But do not think too badly of Mordred either. The course of his own history may have gone very differently if only one time, long ago, someone close to him had apologized, or at the least stood by him when it would have cost little to do so. But no one did, and we shall all pay the price for that error, I'm afraid.
The companions each thanked the cartographer in turn, and left the map-covered room. He was back at his desk working before they closed the door. The cartographer of Lost Places scumbled lines on the parchment at a furious pace for several minutes, before finally capping his quill and laying it aside. He removed his glasses and rubbed his eyes, weary, and not for the first time. He suspected, but did not know, not for certain, what was to follow in the archipelago, and in the world beyond. But what was to take place in the underneath was a complete mystery. All that he knew was that the caretakers, particularly the one called John, must find their way through the maelstrom of events on their own. It would be the only way for them to be prepared when the Imago finally arrived.
"So, the end justifies the means, eh?" he murmured. "This is a dangerous game you play at, Jules. It's beyond me, and I was more than 3 millennia old before you were born. But one of them should have been told. He should know that he will not see the end of it. It's only right, only just, isn't it?"
He waited, almost as if he expected a response, but none came. With a deep sigh, the cartographer picked up his quill, dipped it into the inkwell, and resumed his work. Chapter 11. Camonos Liber. The companions expected an easier descent down the tower, but they soon realized it wasn't to be. The rumbling they experienced earlier had resumed at an increasing pace, accompanied by vibrations that nearly shook them from the stairs. They kept close to the walls and moved as quickly as they dared.
"I think it's the instability the cartographer mentioned,"
Bert in the lead called over his shoulder.
"More pieces of the tower are crumbling."
"I hope we moored the ship high enough," said Jack. "It would be a sorry mess to find it had drifted free because the wall it was tied to suddenly fell into the ocean."
"Don't worry," Avon said. "Her crew is good. They'll keep the airship close, and we'll be watching for us."
"Good to know," said Jack, sounding less than reassured. They were close enough to the bottom to see open sky below when a tremor struck and dislodged the entirety of the counterclockwise stair. It fell past, taking chunks of the clockwise stair with it, along with several doors.
"Glad we are not going up," Charles remarked. "Actually, I'm glad we're leaving altogether."
Bert stopped them, putting his arm out protectively. He looked at Avon, and her brow creased with worry.
"We should have already come to the window where the Indigo Dragon was tethered," Bert said. "That we haven't only means that that part of the tower has already fallen."
They were 30 feet from the disintegrating base, and below that was open air. Above, there were sections of steps missing. They could go no farther down, but neither could they go back the way they'd come. They were trapped.
"What can we do?" asked Jack.
As if in answer to his question, a familiar whirring noise rose outside the nearest window, and the indigo dragon came into view. One of the fawns expertly tossed a line through the opening. Avon caught it and secured it through the bracing under the steps, then pulled over the rope ladder.
"You first," she said to Jack.
"I'll wait, thanks," he replied.
"Charles?"
"Already over here,"
Charles said, waving happily from the deck.
"I was motivated."
Bert went next, then John. Jack was about to cross when another violent shudder shook the tower and the stairway collapsed. Jack was halfway onto the ladder, but Avon had been standing on the steps. There was no time to shout. It was all she could do to flail about for some kind of purchase, and she managed to twist the anchor line around her wrist before she fell. The other end was still tied to the bracing, which weighed several hundred pounds. Avon cried out with the pain and tried to reach up to Jack, but he was too far out of reach.
"Avon!" Bert screamed. "Jack, can you reach her?"
"I'm trying," Jack gasped. "Give me a minute."
That was more time than they had. The weight of the bracing was dragging Avon down and pulling the indigo dragon dangerously close to the tower.
"Cut the line," Avon hissed.
"Never,"
said Jack. "Hang on, I'm coming."
He wound his feet through the ladder and swung backward, upside down, but it was no use. Her outstretched hand was still too far to reach. The airship lurched sideways again, and the propellers screamed with the strain. It was a losing battle. Slowly the ship was being pulled closer to the wall.
"Cut the line, Jack," Avon said again. "Save the ship."
"I'm not going to do that," Jack yelled back. "I made a promise to look after you, and I'm keeping it."
The look in her eyes softened, but she saw the situation more clearly than he did.
"I can't reach my knife to cut myself loose," she said. "Not like this. And we're all dead if the airship smashes into the wall. Cut me loose. It's the only way."
Jack looked at her, only a few feet away, and stretched his arms in despair. Grinding his teeth, he called up to Bert.
"Throw me a knife, quickly."
One of the fawns clambered out onto the ladder as the ship jolted close enough to the tower to scrape a propeller against the stone, sending a shower of sparks over them. He passed a short dagger down to Jack, who took a deep breath and looked at Avon.
"Cut the line, Jack," she said softly.
And with a single stroke, to the horror of his friends, he did. Avon dropped away into the mist without a sound.
"Jack!"
Bert screamed as the shaken young man rushed across the ladder and onto the deck.
"What have you done? What have you done?"
Jack ignored him and ran to the wheel.
"We have 2 miles," he yelled to the crew. "Cut away anything that will drag us back. And dive! We can still catch her! Dive! Now!"
The crew responded instantly, shifting the rudder, spars, and propellers to alter the pitch of the ship. With a vicious jolt, the indigo dragon tipped downward and began to drop. John, Charles, and Bert grabbed hold of whatever they could and braced themselves. The fawns, seemingly oblivious to the danger, were cutting off anything that created wind resistance. The anchor, gone. The rope ladders, gone. Even the extra casks of food and drink were quickly tossed over the railing to disappear in the airstream above them, so they could gain more speed. Faster and faster the ship flew, but in seconds, it was obvious it would not be fast enough. The time it had taken Jack to get aboard again and take charge of the ship would cost them dearly.
"We have to go faster," Jack yelled, looking around. "The balloon! It's creating too much resistance. We have to deflate it." "Are you crazy?" Bert shouted back. "It's what's keeping us aloft. It won't do any good to save Avon if we crash and die right after." "No one's going to die today," said Jack. "John, take the wheel."
John staggered forward and clutched at the wheel, while Jack leapt over his friend and grabbed Avon's sword from its place above the cabin door. Wrapping one of the guy lines around his wrist, he jumped into the air, and the line snapped taut, holding him parallel to the rearmost part of the balloon. With one long stroke, Jack split the center seam on the back of the balloon, and the gases inside escaped with a roar. In an instant, the airship had become an air rocket, and it was hurtling even faster toward the water.
"I see her,"
John shouted, pointing. Below them, Now free of the line and the stair-bracing that had trapped her, Avon was attempting to slow her descent by spreading her arms and legs. It was working. Between her push against